Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm so glad to see so many people here. Sounds exciting. Sounds like we have something really going right now. But before I get started, I do want to certainly recognize Justin Amash for that. Very nice introduction, and he makes it so much less lonely in Washington these days. And Justin, you know, has been there just the first term, but it followed up from, I met him about 4 years ago. So the country is changing, the Congress is changing, but we have a lot more to do. What I say quite frequently, the people are way ahead of the Congress. Congress is still asleep, and that is our job, to wake up Congress and the entire Washington. But also, it's a pleasure to be in the hometown of my brother, Dave Paul. He's a minister here in Hudsonville, and he's with me today. He has some of his grandchildren. I have one of my grandchildren here. Linda is with me today. This is Linda. But then I brought my wife along, and I think a few of you have met my wife, Carol. But it is so nice to see such a nice crowd. In Washington, I would on occasion give speeches on the House floor, but I never got applause, so that's why I like to give speeches outside Washington. It's much more fun. But like I said, the country is much further ahead, and I think this has been true for a long time. The people are way ahead of the Congress. I figure Congress is about 20 years behind. But what we need to do is turn the clock up, speed it up a little bit. We need changes quicker now than ever before. For years, I used to say, and a lot of people still say it, and there's some truth to it, and that is that we can't keep spending this money and borrowing the money, or we're going to pass this debt on to our children. But I don't say that as much anymore, because I think the next generation that was going to get this debt passed on to, I think we are that generation that inherited the problems of the last 40 years, and that's why we have to deal with our problems right now. If I were to simplify our problems, I would say that we've gotten to this mess because we have sent too many people to Washington that have not taken their oath of office seriously and have not done what they should have. I think the people have been lax. They keep getting them reelected. So it's not all just the Congress and just the president. The people have been lax as well. But we need to, you know, change this by changing the people's attitude about what the government should be doing. And let me tell you, the government, under our Constitution, is not supposed to be running a welfare state nor a warfare state. It's there to protect our liberties. That's what the job is. I think most people recognize the crisis now mainly for economic reasons. 4 or 5 years ago, you know, the bubble burst. A few of us talked about that over the years, especially the Austrian free market economists. They have been right on their predictions, and they have predicted that this would come, and it did come. But now most of the people realize, not only in this country but around the world, this is not a U.S. problem, because we're living with a problem that has been developed differently than ever before, because we have been the issuer of a fiat currency called the dollar, and the dollar has been used as a reserve currency as if it were gold, and therefore the inflationary problems of the world and all the distortions and all the debt crisis is worldwide, and therefore we're facing this, a crisis bigger than ever. So the recognition is there. And this is not all that bad, because it's when people live with their head in the sand that we keep doing the same thing over and over again. And right now, people are waking up and saying, you can't solve the problem of too much spending and too much borrowing and too much debt and too much printing press money by merely doing the same thing over and over again. So that's why I'm optimistic that the people know now that we can't continue on the same course that we have been doing for at least the last 40 to 50 years. The economy is obviously the big issue, and certainly in a state like Michigan, that is the big issue, and it has to be addressed. Some states do better than other states. There are some states in the South that do better than the states in the North, and it's not all accident. The federal government does a lousy job providing the environment necessary to be competitive and to be able to compete in throughout the world, because they overtax, they overregulate, and they distort the economy with the inflation, distort the interest rates. So the federal government has a lot of responsibility. In particular, there's one group of people that we should deal with, and I'll talk more about that, and that is that group that's located over in the Federal Reserve building that we have to deal with. There you go. Now that you want to talk about the Federal Reserve System, you know, it's been around for 99 years, and they've literally destroyed 99% of the dollar they inherited in 1913. So they're doing a wonderful job, and one of their mandates is a stable dollar and stable prices. I don't think they've done a very good job. The other mandate they have is low unemployment, and they haven't done a very good job there either. But the problems that the federal government with the mandates and the regulations and all that, that's a big thing. But some states suffer more because some states put a greater burden because you have local regulations. And I think the issue mentioned in the introduction is a big issue, and that is the cost of labor. The cost of labor should be competitive. People should be able to, negotiate. And the contract is what's supposed to decide how workers come together and business people come together. There should be no laws prohibiting the organization of labor. Labor should have a right to organize and talk. And then they have a right to negotiate with business, and business and labor should come together. This is the way a market would work. Who knows, in a totally free market, you might have competitive unions, for all that we know, to try to compete for the best job and provide the best workers. But it's in 1935, when they didn't understand the Depression. They claimed the Depression came about because of free markets, capitalism, and the gold standard. So therefore, what did they do? They destroyed the gold standard and brought up a lot more regulations and destroyed the free market and gave us this intervention Keynesianism, which we've been living with for a long, long time. But in 1935, they gave us the National Labor Relations Act, and this distorted the balance. It didn't deal with the right to organize and the right to contract. It said if you want to get together and organize, you have special power. So when they talk about getting workers' rights back, I think they're misleading, because they're not rights to get a clout from the government. Now, big business gets clouts too, and that's wrong, but big labor is not supposed to get bigger power. Now, the compensation that has occurred over the years, states have gone and tried to get around this by having right-to-work laws and try to compensate for the special powers that have been granted to the unions. So this distorts the market, and the states that have not compensated, they have suffered the very most. And therefore, it has to be addressed. Now, I support a national right-to-work law. And some of the other candidates do not support that law, even though they are conservative Republicans. But it's in the first question that should come if somebody wants to challenge you, says, well, how can you support a national law? You don't believe in these national laws. What's going on? Well, actually, it isn't a new law, new process. It's to cancel out that special authority. It's to remove a special power and clout that was given in the 1935s. So that would be a big help for a state like this if you want to get the economy moving again. I just think of the companies that got into trouble in this breakdown just 4 or 5 years ago, the auto companies that got into trouble. There were a lot of auto companies that were in the South run by other companies, and they didn't have the same problem. So to put our head in the sand and say that this has to happen and persist. But even the bailouts of the company, it wasn't, once again, governments are supposed to be there to guarantee contracts, protect contracts, enforce contracts. So what did the government do come in when they bailed out? They took money from people they shouldn't have taken money to, and then given the money and the bailout and protected individuals that didn't deserve the protection. So the government should be restrained to protecting contract, protecting the marketplace, protecting private property, and they ought to reduce the amount of regulations, and they ought to give us a sound currency. That's what would help our economy today. The other major problem we have faced these last 5 years is the inability of politicians to allow the correction to occur. Corrections, when mistakes are made, you're supposed to have a correction. But nobody wants to go through the correction. So they say, well, what we have to do is bail out companies and the various things because the correction is the way they say too painful. If you don't have the bailouts, there's going to be a depression. And there was some truth to that. The people who had overextended, who especially in the housing bubble, abused it, got into the derivatives market, and they were gambling with all these derivatives. Yes, they were in big trouble, and the banks owned them, and all the insurance companies and the banks were very much involved. So they said, there's going to be a crisis. It's going to be major. They're too big to fail. Well, the truth is the free market tries to correct the problems of government. They should have failed. They're the ones who should have failed, not... But instead, what happened is the Congress, as well as the Federal Reserve, went and bought up all the bad debt. They didn't liquidate the debt. If you or I get into trouble and we're in our heads, over our heads with debt, and we want to have our own economic growth again, we have to get our debt out of the way so that we don't have to keep paying interest and accumulating more and more debt, or eventually we can't borrow any more money. A country has to do that too. The debt has to be liquidated. But when they bailed out these countries, the debt was propped up. Japan did the same thing 20 years ago, and they're still in trouble. So what happened to the debt? Did the companies who held the debt and made all the money, are they stuck with it? No, it's on our shoulders, on the middle class America, and that's why middle class America is suffering. And the very people the bleeding hearts wanted to help and give a free house to, guess what? They're the ones who lost their jobs and lost their houses, and they're suffering the consequence of the inflation now. So government intervention and government planning, whether it's through the Federal Reserve or through Congress, doesn't work. The people have to plan. The people may have to decide how the money is being spent, not the government and not the politicians and not the bureaucrats. Today, though, we have not resolved that, and it is yet to come because this debt is still hanging. Not only that, is our government, our Secretary of the Treasury, as well as the Federal Reserve, have traveled quite frequently, and they talk to the Europeans all the time. And they have essentially promised that we will bail out Europe because we have the reserve currency and there's still some trust in the dollar. So they have essentially said, we will be there. We will not let those banks fail. Guess who the banks are? They're big banks that we have that have branch banks over there. They're intertwined. They're global in nature. And guess what? The banks and the branches in Europe, guess what they bought? They bought debt from Greece and Portugal and Spain. And they say, well, the debt is illiquid now. What are we going to do? Illiquid means it's worthless. But they own it. They don't want to go bankrupt. So we're over there promising more that we will be bailing them out by printing more money. But the tough part of this, and they better wake up and understand it, is that you just can't do that forever. Eventually, what it does, it destroys the confidence in the dollar. And right now, I think that is happening. Because now the money is starting to circulate. It's been produced, created in the last 4 or 5 years. You've heard about gasoline prices. There's one place in Florida, gasoline prices hit $6 the other day. And yet, what does Bernanke tell us? Bernanke tells us there's no inflation. Of course, he has a different definition of inflation. Inflation, technically, in the free market, is when you print money and create money. He's tripled the supply of money in these last 3 years. That's inflation. And then one of the consequences of inflating the currency are higher prices. So over the years, what have we had? We had high prices in the NASDAQ bubble, and we had high prices in the housing bubble. We have high prices wherever government gets their fingers involved. In education, prices of education, much higher than the cost of living. Cost of medical care, it's very, very high. And then they tell you, you know, there isn't any inflation. But even if you use the old calculation for the CPI, our price is going up about 7%, and he's telling us it's going up 2%. So in other words, let's say it is 2%. What he's telling us is that they're allowed to steal 2% of our money every single year and not be charged with a crime. Matter of fact, I've asked both Greenspan and Bernanke in committee about this, about the morality of it and the economics of it. And they said, well, we have to keep interest rates low, and we have to do this to keep the economy going. We have to look at the big picture, and some people just are going to suffer. Now, that is not very nice, because guess who suffers? The very people who might want to take care of themselves, the people who save money, the people in retirement, people living on Social Security, because their cost of living right now is going up a lot more than 2%. So he says that's a consequence. Now, if you had a free market, you know what people might make on their CDs? It could be 6 or 7 or 8%, because that's where the market would be. But the other major problem when the Fed gets involved in artificially lower interest rates, it causes what we call malinvestment. People do things they shouldn't be doing. Even if you don't see the prices rising, they invest because they think there's been a lot of savings. They might build too many houses or build too many casinos down in Las Vegas and all the different things. So this is the mischief of the Federal Reserve, and eventually it'll be dealt with. This is not new. Destruction of money has been around for a long time, and inevitably, when they finally destroy the currency, they always have to go back to something that people know about and they trust, and they go back, just as the founders went back. They had runaway inflation with the continental dollar. They put it in the Constitution. Only gold and silver can be legal tender. And they also said you could not emit bills of credit, which is paper money. And they also said, we give you no authority to establish a central bank. Now, immediately, there was a great debate between Jefferson and Hamilton. In the early years, of course, they kept getting rid of the national bank. But we've been suffering with this for the last 100 years. So I'm hoping on the 100th anniversary that we have a bill that we can pass that says on the 100th anniversary of the Federal Reserve, we're going to have a bill that's going to repeal the Federal Reserve Act. The other major flaw with a monetary system like this, it enables governments to grow in a sinister manner. Jefferson didn't want to even be able to borrow money, but he didn't win that fight. But if they taxed us for everything that they do, and we had to send them a check every month, believe me, this would all end rather quickly because the people would rebel. Matter of fact, just to make that point, I introduced a bill one time to repeal withholding taxes. Why should the businessman be a slave and collect these papers and fill out all these forms? But the The real benefit would be the people would know how much they're paying for the government, and there would be a quick rebellion that would get us back on track again. But because the borrowing can become noticeable, if you didn't have the Fed to monetize debt, the borrowing would push interest rates up, and then the Congress would have to quit spending because the more they spent, the higher the interest rates go up. But we don't have that check. And so we have the Federal Reserve that just prints the money when the federal government needs the money. So it does hide things, and the victims are sometimes unknown. They're not known immediately, and they can get away with that until the end point when the currency is destroyed. But in the meantime, you might have decades of this. We went off the gold standard completely in 1971. These last 40 years have been nothing but a big bubble being formed. But during that time, just think of what has grown. The entitlement system and the warfare system. The military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about, it's alive and well, and they're spending money. And the thing that really, even though I've studied this for a long time about in Congress, and I know how so many of you feel, they're living with their head in the sand. They're in oblivion in Washington. They don't even, if they thought that the problem was one-tenth as serious as I think that it is, they would quit spending. That's what they should do. But the whole system fed on itself. The entitlement system is alive and well. Politicians did quite well by, you know, just promising whatever the people wanted. We could borrow, spend. We're a wealthy nation, and we were. We were the wealthiest nation ever because we were the freest nation. Of course, today, we're not the freest nation, and we're not the richest nation anymore. But the entitlement system got way off base because entitlement sounds like a good word. You know, we would like to say we're entitled to our right to our life and to our liberties, but we're not entitled to somebody else's money. Entitlements have become what people, through the politician, demand or want or insist on, and the politicians accommodate, and they become entitlements. And literally, I imagine more than 50% of the people in this country still think that an entitlement is a right. But an entitlement isn't a right. We get our lives and our liberty from our Creator. We get it in a natural way. We don't get it from the government, but if we have a right to our life and our liberties, we ought to have a right to keep the fruits of our labor. Which of course means there would be no income tax if you could live with that. You know, a lot of people will challenge me, of course, because I want to start off the first year with, you know, a token cut of $1 trillion. And they say, and quite frequently, the questions are very sincere because they've studied only Keynesian economics. And I say, well, what will happen? We're in a recession. What would happen if the government quit spending $1 trillion? I said, well, think of it this way. It isn't so much that the government's going to, the fact that the government's quitting spending $1 trillion. It would be that the government would quit spending it and the people would spend $1 trillion. And that's what would happen, and that would be much better. I, quite frankly, am very frank about what I think the nature and the philosophy of a president ought to be. The president shouldn't be running the economy. You know, the president doesn't know what to do. The Congress doesn't know what to do. Only the people know what to do on how to run the economy. Now, I don't say that we can get out of this mess by snapping our fingers and everything will be perfect, but I know what we're doing is wrong, is prolonging the agony, and it's going to be worse in our depression if we don't change our ways. But what we need to do, though, is not scare people with what the correction is all about. Because I don't think we should propose our viewpoints by saying, well, I have the problems as long as you're willing to sacrifice. But why would it be that if I came along and talked to the businessman and to you in this audience and say, look, what I want to do is I want to deregulate you. I don't want the federal government down in your states and having mandates. I don't think that's a sacrifice to have less regulations from the federal government. And how would it be a sacrifice to you if it could, if you could trust the currency? How many here now would say, well, I'm saving for my children's education. I'm going to buy a 20-year bond and make a 0.5% or 0.25%, and I know I'll have the purchasing power in 20 years. Nobody believes that, you know. So what if you had sound money and you could save money and you could be confident that you can take care of your future? What else? Not only that, the prices of education would come down. But why would it be a sacrifice to us if you didn't have any income tax? That doesn't sound like a sacrifice to me. I would think this would be wonderful. But not only would we have to change, the people have to change their attitude about what the role of government ought to be. And that is important because no matter how many people you have in Washington, they will reflect the demands of the people. So if the people still say entitlements are rights and we want to steal money from one group and you give it to us, it's not going to work. So we have to change the people's attitude about the role of government. But there's another area that we have to at least address, and I believe we have to change to get this correction over with. And that has to do with what we're doing overseas. We're spending, the DOD budget's not this big, but believe me, there are a lot of other budgets that are involved in what we're doing overseas. The intervention, the State Department, the CIA, our troops, and taking care of the wounded and all, it's costing us over $1 trillion. Our wars in the last 10, 11 years now, has added $4 trillion worth of debt to our national debt. But just think of, what if we'd have had this $4 trillion in the economy? Just think how much richer this economy would be. And what have we gotten for all these wars? We've gotten nothing but grief. I mean, we're not spreading our Constitution. We're not spreading our goodness. We're spreading a viewpoint of America, which I don't think is a good viewpoint of America. A lot of people believe they have a moral obligation, starting with Woodrow Wilson, that we had to prove to the world that we were the most moral and most wise nation, and we had the right and the obligation to force our way and to teach other people. This though doesn't work. Using force to force our goodness on anybody cancels out all the goodness. Now, America has been a great country, the freest and the richest, and we have a lot of wonderful traits and wonderful characteristics that we want to. But why don't we concentrate on a free market economy, a sound currency, protection of civil liberties, a sensible foreign policy, and then we could be a nation where other countries would want to emulate us and follow our lead. But unless we change our attitude, and that means the people, about how much we should be involved overseas, it's not going to happen. We're going to work to the bankruptcy, and that's not real far off. So my position is that it should be a lot easier for liberals and conservatives and independents to come together and cut overseas spending and cut these wars. That's what I think would be the easiest thing to cut. which simply means we bring our troops home as soon as possible. Now, the other thing about this is that it's a way to work our way out of it. If we don't work our way out of it and have a dollar collapse, everybody's checks bounce. And then you have political chaos, and then I worry about our civil liberties. But if we do this sensibly and cut this spending overseas, what about all this effort to worry about a border that nobody can identify between Pakistan and Afghanistan? Think of how much fighting and killing we're going over there. Nobody even knows where at all, so we just bomb everybody, you know. But what about our own borders to the south? There's a responsibility of the federal government. We could do that with a lot less resources than worrying about all those overseas border. And in the last 5 years, it is estimated that 50,000 people have been killed on that border down there. And it involves not only, I think, less so the immigration problem than our failed policy on the drug war, I think, is part of the reason. But we once again would have to change our foreign policy and adapt the policy that the founders gave us. And even up until the mid part of the last century, many conservative Republicans endorsed. And that is that we ought to mind our own business. And but they'll come up with all these arguments. Well, there's a civil war going over there and people are getting killed. They have no idea who the good guys and the bad guys are. There's probably bad guys on both sides, but we have to get involved, they say. But how many times did we get involved with the most vicious of dictators, you know, from Stalin to Mao Zedong and all these people? They killed millions, and yet we did business with them. So this whole idea that there's war propaganda going on. War drums are beating. They're ready to go into Syria. We don't need a war in Syria, and we don't need a war in Iran. I'll tell you that. Now, the big economic advantage of this, if we decide to work our way out, which is what I'm working to do, and that is if you cut back, you don't have to cut child health care, or you don't have to cut benefits to the elderly. Some of those programs should never have been started. I'm not going to defend this stuff on constitutional grounds, but on practical grounds, if you want to deal with this and deal in a practical way, let's cut this spending overseas and try to take care of the people that we have taught for 50 years to become dependent on the federal government, and then work our way out. One of the proposals in my bill is to take care of the people who are dependent and need to help, but I would offer the chance, you know, to change the Social Security system, and for instance, to start off with anybody under 25 getting out of college. Let them get out of Social Security. Let them take care of themselves. Now, that, of course, wouldn't work unless you do the cutting, and that's why we have to change the foreign policy. But the founders were very, very clear on this, and they advised strongly, don't get involved in entangling alliances, don't be the policeman of the world, and don't get involved. But their advice was trade with people and talk to people and not try to solve all their other problems. But today we do exactly the opposite. I think one of the most foolish examples of putting on sanctions not at the time, but now. Don't you think sanctions on Cuba have been long enough? Other countries are doing business with them. Communism is dead. What I'm worried about is the current system of government interventionism and inflationism and the problems we have today. That's our real threat. Besides, Besides, the countries that we do end up trading with, you know, we the French and the Americans killed a million, probably close to a million or more. The Vietnamese, we finally left. We lost 60,000, and we lost that war, and they said there would be a domino effect and communism would spread throughout the world. It didn't happen. China became our banker. Now we do business with the Vietnamese. And just think of what's happened since we left there in the 1973 or so. Since we've left there, think of what happened with peace would never happen with war. So why are we so determined, this country, to think that it is necessary? And, you know, there's an economic theory behind this, which is a dangerous theory. The claim was that the Depression came because of the gold standard and capitalism. But we didn't get out of the Depression until we had World War II. Now, that is foolish thinking, because war never helps your economy. It never helps. Now, the reason of the fallacy is there was the unemployment rate went down, you know, because everybody was over, the 10 million people went overseas fighting. But a lot of people argue with me about my $1 trillion of cut in spending, because they've been taught, the Keynesian teachers, government's supposed to spend more money when you're in trouble. And they said that if you do this, won't this really hurt the economy? But think about it. If you have $1 trillion and you cut it, of course the people are going to get to cut it. But after World War II, 10 million military people came home. We cut the budget by 60%. Taxes went down 30%. That's when the Depression ended. They came back. That's what ends depressions. But when we come around to understanding that we do have a responsibility for strong national defense, we have to have a strong national defense, but the founders tried their best to protect us against the king going to war. But unfortunately, the presidents we've had in recent history have acted like kings, have not gotten the permission from you through your congressman voting up and down for a war. If we did that, we wouldn't have gone to war, and if we had to go to war, we'd fight them, win them, and they would come home. You know, the Iraq war was fought, as a consequence or a sequence from 9/11. It had nothing to do with 9/11, because there was no weapons of mass destruction, no Al-Qaeda there. But when they came up with the resolution, I was on the Iraq, on the International Relations Committee, the resolution said, not a declaration of war. They said the president can do whatever he wants. Essentially that. If you want to go to war, fine. If you don't, you don't have to. And that was how they reneged on the responsibility, which sort of upset me a bit. And so I introduced a substitute resolution and said, okay, I told the committee, I said, look, you guys want to go to war? I don't want to go to war. But I'm offering a resolution of a declaration of war. I said, I'm not going to vote for it, but if you want to go to war, you vote it up and down. Of course, oh, they were furious. Oh, no. And then they did voice vote and voted down. I said, I'm going to make you record the vote that you voted against the declaration of war. But it was explained to me by the committee chairman of the time that trying to explain to me the Constitution, he said, that part of the Constitution is anachronistic. We don't follow that part of the Constitution anymore. That tells you why we're in trouble today, because the Constitution doesn't mean a whole lot. They ignore it. The courts overrule it, and it's a real mess. We got into this mess by not following it. We could get out of it by sending only people to Washington that will obey the Constitution. The other serious consequence of big government, whether it's for the entitlement welfare system or for the warfare system, because the bigger the government gets, the smaller the people get, the less liberties we have. It's characteristic under a war that civil liberties are compromised. People have sort of accepted this idea, well, under these special emergency conditions, we have to give up a little bit of our liberties. Let me tell you, you don't. You don't have to give up liberties to be safe. But today it is said that we have a perpetual war. It's worldwide, any country, and we're in 130 countries, 900 bases, because we're fighting a war on terrorism. We're fighting the Taliban. The Taliban are people who just want us out of their country. You know, that's what they want. But the war is worldwide. And therefore, we should expect that a continuation of an attack on our civil liberties, much worse than I think it's been in the past. Today, of course, immediately after 9/11, I voted for the support to go after the al-Qaeda. That is proper, even though I saw our foreign policies being seriously flawed, contributing to that problem. But they attack us. We got to deal with it. We go get them. But we didn't even catch bin Laden for 10 years, and we went and occupied two countries, and in a country that had zero to do with it. So what did they do to the American people? We suffered from the consequence of that. Within 2 weeks, they had a bill on the floor they had been trying to pass for a couple years, and that bill was called the Patriot Act. So that was voted very easily. I was sitting beside a member of Congress on that day, and I saw he was voting for it. I was voting against it. Voting against it. And I said, why? I said, why are you voting for this bill? I said, you know, it's only been on the floor for an hour. We don't even know exactly what's in it. He said, well, I know that. And I said, you didn't read it. No, I didn't read it. And I said, you know there's going to be bad stuff in there. Yeah, I know that. I said, why are you voting for it? He says, how can I go home and tell my people back at home that I voted for the Patriot Act right after 9/11? He said, that would be a difficult thing to explain. I said, but that's your job. Go home and explain it to them. But almost always, if you look at a bill's name on coming out of Congress, it's almost inevitable that it's going to do the opposite of what it says. So it was a very unpatriotic bill. If they would have called it the Repeal the Fourth Amendment Act, I guess nobody would have voted for it. So next year, when we get a chance to repeal this, we won't call it Repeal the Patriot Act. We'll call it Restore the Fourth Amendment Act. Then, of course, the TSA couldn't assume that they have a right to search, seed, and prod us all at the airport and sacrifice all our liberties and humiliated the boot. But, you know, a year ago, the president announced in this progress against our liberties, he announced that it is a proper procedure for the president of the United States to assassinate American citizens on his say. And to prove his point, he did it. He's done it 3 times already. But the Congress hasn't been much better. The Congress passed a bill. The president signed it on January 1st of this year, the National Defense Authorization Act with... Which Justin mentioned, because he was positively opposed to it, as I was. But this bill literally repeals posse comitatus, keeping the military out of state civil laws. It allows the military to arrest any American citizen if he's associated with any particular group. Just associated. No charges made. No trials. He can be arrested, put in a secret prison, denied an attorney, and kept indefinitely. And that's on the books. We put it on the books. That has to be reversed. Now, you think that was pretty bold on what they did, but there was one other provision that fortunately was removed. There was a provision that was in the bill and nearly passed, and it had gone through the House, and it was coming out of the Senate. But when it was on the Senate floor, and the provision said that if you are arrested and you are charged and you have a trial and you're found innocent, they could still keep you indefinitely in a prison. But fortunately, there was a senator from, I think it was Kentucky, that got that removed. Well, I think you knew about all those problems. I don't think I've given you anything new. But you've given me some more energy because of enthusiasm, because I know you're out there, and there are a lot of people out there, and the numbers are growing by leaps and bounds. The revolution is alive and well, and it's an intellectual revolution, and let me tell you, there are a lot of young people wanting to lead the charge, and that's great with me. But there are a lot of others in an older generation that has been rather frustrated over the years, disgusted with both parties, and they're being energized by everybody together now that they're realizing that the end stage is getting closer for the system that we have. And that should encourage all of us, because it's well-grounded, it's sound, there's sound economics and sound constitutional principles, sound moral judgment about what we should do. At least in this crowd, I wouldn't expect anybody to boo me for suggesting that we have that we apply a golden rule to our foreign policy. You know, John Adams said that what we need is a tireless, irate minority. We don't need the majority. You need a minority, because that's the way it is all the time, because they energize the rest of the people. So it's never what we have today, and even under communism, you don't have 51% voting for this. It's a irate majority, a minority that emphasizes this. But this is what we have today. We have it, and it's growing, and we are influencing other people. We are in transition. I think Justin coming to Congress is representing this. There's going to be a lot more people coming to Congress. And if you look at what's happening across the country, we can't even keep track of it all. I go around the country. This really got moving about 4 years ago, but I meet people who are in office. They're state representatives and local offices. They're all over the place, and this is wonderful. That's how a real revolution occurs. And ultimately, if these ideas are to prevail, they will not be Republican ideas. They have to be pervasive and invade both Democrats, independents, and Republicans alike, because that is what we're facing today. Nixon said it all when he claimed that the reason why he had to get us off the gold standard and put on wage and price controls, he said, we're all Keynesians now. But someday we have to reverse that. We need the people to say, we all believe in the free market and sound money now. And it's been said that an idea whose time has come, it cannot be stopped by anything military. The armies can't stop it. Governments can't stop it. And I really do believe these ideas whose time has come. And they're not brand new. I didn't invent them. They're not new. It's part of our American tradition. It's part of a tradition that's been going on for many hundreds of years. But these ideas have only been tested in a small manner. But the best test has been here in this country. And then we became the wealthiest and the largest middle class ever. And now, of course, the middle class is shrinking, and we're greatly in debt. We're getting poorer. So our test is going to fade unless we pick up those pieces and refine it. We don't have to go back to anything. We don't have to go back to the 19th century gold standard, because there's a better understanding about gold and money than there ever was. There's better understanding of economic policies, entitlement system. So this is the reason that we put this to, if we put this together and bring people together, this is going to work. And that is what freedom does. It brings people together. We'll never agree on how we want to use our freedoms. Because we'll never agree in a room like this. There might be 50 different religious values and some with no Christian religious values at all. But freedom answers the question because we don't impose ourselves on other people. You do what you want. And this should be true not only in religious values, but economic values, this idea that the government has to take care of us and protect us from ourselves and make sure no single person falls through the crack. The more they try to prevent people from falling through the crack, the more people fall through the cracks. That's what the problem is. So we don't want to tell other people how to spend their money. Does that mean some won't do a good job and they might have problems? That is true. But it will also incite people to do more for themselves. They will have a greater incentive, and there will be a family responsibility, a community responsibility, a more local responsibility. There will be greater wealth in a country. There is no doubt that history shows that the freer a country, the wealthier a country. And we've lost the moral high ground because we give it up to people who say, no, the only way you can spread fairness around the world and around this country is by government force, by forcibly redistributing wealth and regulating. It doesn't work. It leads to the crisis that we have here today. So therefore, we have to have a firmer grasp of how freedom works, how the marketplace works, and why you have to have sound money. And it will change. That's all there is to it. But that's where we're making the great progress. This is why it is so wonderful what is happening. We should be optimistic about it, but not casual about it. We can't say this is going to be easy, because those who are in charge and who have control of the money system and control of the financial system and control of the military and the foreign policy, they will not go away quietly. And yet, this will end because, like I said the other night on TV, they don't accept, the opposition won't accept the moral and a constitution argument. They will not be able to get away from the economic argument because this can't go on because we won't have the money to pursue these policies. Benjamin Franklin once said, those who expect to enjoy the fruits of liberty must, like man, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. So there is some fatigue. I don't like to call it sacrifice, but there is some fatigue, and there is some effort. So in many ways, those of you who would come to a meeting like this have a greater responsibility, because the masses out there will not be understanding the same things that you do. So if you understand this, you have to bear the burden of the responsibility of doing something about it, because it's a greater burden. But if you believe in it, that's what has to happen. And a lot of people come up to you and say, okay, what do you want me to do? And you know, my answer is, do whatever you want to do. Do what you want. Everybody will have a different role to play. Some will run for Congress, other offices. Some will support people. Some will make a lot of money, encourage us by donating money. Who knows what people will do? But I think the most important thing that we all do, which I try very hard to do and continue to do, which I learned early on, is try to understand why how you can place these arguments down and compete with the arguments. So it's education. Ultimately, education is the test. But just think of what we have on nightly TV. And I get frustrated because I never get asked questions from an Austrian economic viewpoint. But they haven't been taught it. Most of them don't even have the vaguest idea what they are. So this is the thing. So education is important. Then you say, well, then what I do? Well, I'll tell you what, there'll be something for you, one way or the other. And that is what's so wonderful. And I really do believe it brings people together. It should be a diverse group, because everybody's going to use their freedoms in a different way, socially or economically. People should come together. So we should come together to fight for the principle which we can all enjoy in a different manner, and that is enjoying the liberty that we have gotten in a natural, God-given way. I thank you very much for coming today. Thank you very much.